Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Shit Show with J-Bo. How the hell are you? I'm doing okay. I just got off work. I just had a scumbag dinner, let's call it, but there's freedom in being a scumbag. I ate three breakfast burritos, fairly small, you know, and an apple, and some flat Diet Coke. And I don't know, I'm standing in the kitchen here, an abandoned kitchen of my cousin's. In my cousin's basement at his house in Cumberland, Maryland. Just chilling, having a good time, standing up, doing this podcast. I got to interview this guy this week. His name is Juan Manuel Larrazabal, and he's an artist from LA. You're going to be hearing from him in just a few minutes. He's an incredible cartoon comic. Comic book artist. He doesn't do cartoons at all. He does comic books. He also is a musician, and he goes by the name Cool Skull. Look that up. Go to Twitter. Just look up Cool Skull. That's K-O-O-L-S-K-U-L-L. Juan Manuel Larrazabal. Cool Skull is a musical project. Primarily, I believe he calls it chip thrash music, which is kind of a lo-fi, 8-bit Game Boy style technology. It's really, really cool. Really chaotic sounding. Kind of noisy. He's a beast. I've seen him perform here on YouTube, and I think you should check him out. I think he's great. He had so much energy when he talked to me. I didn't even have to say a thing, basically. I mean, don't worry. I still probably made it a little bit awkward by trying to interject and trying to direct the conversation. It kind of reminded me of when I talked to Don Bowles, who's also from Los Angeles, and just a whirlwind of personality. Just, it was awesome. I so very much enjoyed talking to Juan Manuel Larrazabal, a.k.a. Cool Skull. I think his politics are great. I think they're brash. I think he's a pretty radical dude. I hope you guys, too, do as well, rather. Listen the whole way to the end. I'm going to put one of his songs at the very end, and I hope you'll enjoy that. I think you will. It's great stuff. This is The Shit Show with J-Bo, and we'll talk soon.
Juan Larrazabal, also known as the Cool Skull. I am the coolest of skulls and essentially one of the new great entertainers of our century. We've got David Bowie, Prince, everyone's dead, and you know, so the and David Bowie's last music video, Black Star, there was a skull that was presented on the moon with crowns and jewels on it. That's me. So yeah, I make like 8-bit music and cartoons and comic books and stuff, and I've been working professionally freelance over the last about 5 years, and I'm kind of getting the hang of the freelance thing and moving into new independent ventures right now, but I'm still consistently making music and art all the time and usually about a song a day, and I'm just obsessively creating and writing stories and stuff. That's what I do.
That's amazing. That's completely amazing. I was actually feeling the spirit rising, man, for whatever that's worth. As I was scrolling through your Facebook feed, I'm like, man, this guy into some serious deep shit, man.
Yeah, well, I'm trying.
What is 8-bit recording?
Well, when I mean 8-bit music, I mean, literally programming the songs on my Game Boy with a program called LSDJ or Little Sound DJ, and it's all like it's a tracker-based sequencer. I can program my own synthesizers and command the sequences to make whatever songs I want. I was doing that a lot when I was 16, 17. And then when I was like 18, 19, I just, instead of going to college, I just toured all over the U.S. and was a little crazy punk rock 8-bit boy with the Game Boy doing crazy shows, getting naked and getting violent.
What was the band's name at that point?
I was called Cool Skull. Cool Skull started officially in like 2007, and this first album came out in 2008. And I wasn't really doing shows until 2009 and 10. And then 2012 was my first tour. So it was a pretty long, weird progression of me doing stuff online as a little hacker boy. And then it started really on the internet net label scene, whereas there was a lot of net labels that were just websites where they just arranged albums from their favorite artists and pushed them and said, hey, here's our new net label release. It's free. You know, that's what I did a lot of. I released probably more than 30 albums through different net labels at that time.
It's so fascinating that it's just you, right? Cool Skull?
Yeah, that was just me, yeah.
I love that model, man. I mean, a band is pretty cool, but it's such a cumbersome thing, and then you have to tour and you possibly pay them, and that sucks. I mean, I've interviewed people like Geneva Jacuzzi as well, who I really admire, and to be able to tour with just such a minimal setup.
That's really cool, actually, that you talked to Geneva Jacuzzi. Yeah, Geneva is an awesome person. I am acquainted with her, and I hung out at her house a few times. I know one of her roommates, and she's a really great person. She's a great artist, and she's another good example of using pretty minimal ideas to get a real maximal output. What I like to kind of call it minimalistic maximalism. You put minimum amount of, not effort, because it's mostly maximum effort, but minimum amount of actual things, whether it be equipment or people involved, but then you get the maximum output, you know. Bands are cumbersome, but I think that also working in a band is the most impressive way to be on stage, and also it requires the most patience moral fortitude for a leader. You know, like to be a band leader, you have to like really keep the morale up of the band, be nice to everybody, and that's what I did wrong. I had a band with my little brother when I was like 12, 13. My brother Emilio, we were called the Interceptors, and we played all over the LA public library system. They were getting the shows and then on the Whiskey Go Go and stuff. It was pretty cool, but it basically didn't work out because I was too painful to work with. I was like, I would just have these like autistic freak out moments where I would just freak out that things weren't right, you know? Right, and my brother was like, dude, fuck this. I got to go work with other people who won't freak out at me, you know? And I still hope to eventually make music with all my brothers, you know, and we're still working on some stuff, but it's like, in order to be a part of a band, it's much more intimate than people assume or think it's going to be. So when you have young kids in a band, they get all into drugs and stuff, because it's a pain in the ass to do it. It's a real strain on you, unless you're really morally aware and spiritually grounded. It's going to be real tough on you, especially if you have like a drug addiction or something, you know, and a lot of people end up having that too, so it makes it all more complicated.
And to be clear to the audience that's listening right now, you are using your father's cell phone right now, correct?
Yeah, I'm using my father's cell phone right now because my iPad wasn't letting me call your number. Yeah. Yeah, I'm using my dad's letting me. Yeah, I'm a rare example of a person who, for some reason, by accident, has two parents who are still around and real nice to me and all that, even though we all have our own issues. Iggy Pop did too, apparently, so yeah, that's a good thing.
Dude, I want to talk about Beat Show a little bit, dude. It's a really cool record. I listened to it almost the whole morning today. I love
it,
man. And it's totally chaotic sounding and interesting and brash and hardcore. And your guests aren't. Tell me a little bit about your guests. I mean, I feel like Ariel Pink actually was probably in the studio with you, but you also had Jordan Peterson featured. I think it's probably just a clip off YouTube, but it's an amazing sentiment. I'm a fan of that guy and Milo and all that. Tell me about the inspiration. It's a very political record. And by the way, I sent it to Alex Jones 15 minutes ago.
Oh, my God, that's amazing. Well, yeah, the album is really chaotic. Electronic music scene does not like any of my political views, but there are a few people who have been standing by me, even if, although they disagree with me, because our relationships in real life have led to quite loving friendships, you know. Like, people in real life understand that my opinions aren't out of anger or anything. They understand that I'm just trying to challenge everyone to think a little bit harder, But yeah, Ariel Pink is a good friend of mine, and when we were recording that Paging Dr. Giggles song, he was like really there. We were really doing that together, yeah. But yeah, the Jordan Peterson sample was just a sample, and the Miley Yiannopoulos sample is just, and they're both people I agree with and disagree with on many different topics, you know?
Sure.
Jordan Peterson, you know what? I like a lot of what he says. I like that he references Carl Jung a lot. I think his idea of an archetype is important. Everybody needs to clean their own room, just like he says. But he also said that Kavanaugh should get down or not take his seat just because someone accused him of what he did. And it's like, no, sorry, dude. I think that's really regressive for you to say that. And I vehemently disagree. But Milo, on the other hand, I agree with most of what he says. I just think that whether or not that what he's saying is true, he's ruining not just his career, but friendships with humans by the way he's acting. You know what I mean?
How do you mean? How do you mean? Like, just, what do you mean how he's acting? I understand. I like Milo as well. I'm just...
Well, okay. Well, I stand by literally 98% of what Milo says. Quite literally.
He's great.
I don't just, like, agree with him. I strongly agree with him.
Yeah.
But there's some off-the-record things that I probably shouldn't even talk about. But just from the knowledge that I've been reading and kind of just like doing a little bit of loose research on his relationship with like Ben Shapiro and the whole Breitbart crew, and then also having some added friends who had some experiences with him in person. I don't want to give away too much because it's like kind of disrespectful to give away too much. But I realized like, oh man, this person. Maybe he's like, you know, changing or learning or making new evolutions, and that's really cool. But I see also in Milo what I've seen in myself, whereas it's a person who just is so contentious with people that they kind of have their entire system crumble, you know, because even in the normal everyday moments, it's really hard for that person to have a casual, friendly conversation, you know? And I see Milo doing that, and I don't hate him for it. In fact, I still like him, and I'll stand by him for what he does. But like I said, the only reason I would criticize that is because it's something that I do, you know? I'm like, oh, I see that. Crap. Damn, dude, you should chill out a little bit, you know?
Yeah, he's fucking up the message by being too aggressive, basically.
But the problem lies right there, because I'm quite confused on this point, too. Like, what do you do? I don't know. Like, these are important things to talk about. You know? I think that it also, you know, business deals and transactions and the way he goes about it is probably not extreme. Like, I don't know. I don't unintelligent spending habits and things like that, I also think that is something that he was into that, you know, didn't need to happen. But, you know, other than that, I love those guys, and that's why I sampled them. And I think it's important. Like, the chiptune music scene, the 8-bit music community is a very small one, and they did their best to denounce me and to throw me to the side based off of some, like, false rape accusations a few years ago. So I know that whatever I do, they're not going to want to pay listen to my record or... I'm not going to get the same listens that I used to. I don't have the same fan base. I'm not going to get a tour in the same way that I used to. So I said, you know, it's true. I'm just going to say whatever I actually want to say because my lifestyle is based exclusively off the money that comes from my art and not from my music. So I was like, whatever. I don't care what they hear on my record. I'll just put it out. I'll sample Tammy Bruce saying I'm a proud conservative, you know, because I think that it's important for people to hear these samples, like not just the main headline, but like the context of what they're explaining, you know.
I think these things are so demonized for a lot of times zero reason that it's so important for a guy like you to be like, look at who I am, look at what I do, and look at who I follow and what I believe, and you're normalizing something that's not preposterous. You know, these people aren't evil. They aren't horrible, but they're looked at that way, and I think you're normalizing it. I think that's a great thing. I think it's really brave, actually, and rebellious. In the spirit, I 100% appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you very much, man. Yeah, I don't really even think anyone should really listen to me or anyone exclusively, but I'm going to say what I think, and I might not be right either, but I want to say that, like, you know, oh, being a conservative is so punk now or whatever, but
yeah,
I just think that the most, any person who, like, lives a long life and lives a long, happy life,
yeah.
Whether or not they say they agree with this or that, there are certain, like, values that they just hold and maintain, you know? Like, you're not, like, a parent who cares about their kids and then also is very liberal with their certain, like, habitual weaknesses in some ways. You know what I mean? Like, a very strong person controls themselves and conserves certain energies for other things, you know? Me and my dad disagree with it. My dad's like, I'm not a conservative. Shit, I'll never be a conservative. Like, hardcore, like, never. But I realize my dad is also probably, in a lot of ways, like, one of the most conservatively acting people. Like, because he actually goes to work on time and conserves his energy for the things that are important. And, you know, and in a lot of ways, like, to last long as a human being, you have to save up and not just waste all your energy on bullshit, you know? And not
literal conservation, yeah, right.
Yeah, quite literal conservation. And in that Tammy Bruce quote, what she said is that the reason she talks about all that stuff is not because she thinks everyone should be in her doctrine, but because the conservative ideology is one that brings freedom to people. Like, if you save up your money and make smarter business decisions, you end up becoming more financially free eventually, you know? Or, like, let's say you're conservative with your sexual life and you give your love to one person or whatever. Eventually that relationship is nurtured and grows into something much larger, you know? And it's because the conserving and saving and taking care of yourself, like, that's what I think that the liberal ideas are extremely vital also. But I think they're mostly important in your brain for yourself, you know, like you should never limit yourself in terms of ideas, but in terms of what you want to express in your art. But then, you know, once you learn a lot of techniques, limiting yourself and giving yourself rules actually builds up efficiency afterward, you know, like working with a Game Boy. I could write a song in, like, 30 minutes on a Game Boy, because I know all the shortcuts and quick keys and all my favorite things to build to do on it. But it took me about, like, 4 years to get used to it, you know? And I think it's, like, you know, like they say, like, talent is, like, the endless, what is it, grind, or years and years of effort and then relaxation. Once you have all the knowledge and effort and then you just relax and then let it flow, then people look at it and be like, oh, that's talent. But yeah, well, you weren't there for the decade that I was grinding while you were partying, you know? Like, I was working really hard. Yeah, well, I know that you put your effort in. You actually listened to my record, which is something that people don't do, so thanks.
Dude, no. Literally, I looked at the track listing in, like, three of my, you know, cultural heroes. Like, you got Ariel Pink. You got Milo Yiannopoulos. You got Jordan Peterson. You know, I was like, wow, this dude's incorporating this stuff in his music. Now, are there... L.A. seems like a freaky place to me. It seems like a place where you might be a small portion of the people, like the people who think like you, but you do have people that are like you. Now, I came from Seattle, man, and Seattle is very homogenous. And one of the reasons I left Seattle, I mean, a lot of things happened, but I couldn't deal with the exact same political thing every time I looked at my Facebook feed. Is L.A. like that? Is L.A. quite diverse? I mean, I understand that its population is color-wise. But ideologically, politically, is it diverse?
Well, I will say that it's much more complex than that. I think that it is not very politically diverse. But I will also add to that that the younger generation, meaning people really 19, 18 and younger, I think that younger people are more open to common sense. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah, I just replied to her.
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay, so for example, when I meet, like, someone who's, like, 16 or 17, or, like, a kid at my show, and they ask me, like, why do you do the MAGA hat and all this and that, you know?
Yeah.
If I explain it to them, like, hey, this is why I think this, this is why I think this, they aren't necessarily converted to my ideology, but they're like, oh, I didn't think of it like that, or dang, that's interesting. I had no idea that someone had that point of view on it, you know, like, for example, the migrant caravan. If I explain to them, like, come on, guys, you can't just have open borders. Obama didn't think we wanted open, should have had open borders, you know?
Correct.
And even if it's, like, some young kid that, like, hates Trump, he'll be like, no, actually, I like that point, you know what I mean? Because I think that the kids, before they go to college, they're not as attached to the names of things, you know? They're not as attached to the symbolic aspect of the ideology.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas I think once the kids go to college and they're actually in these school systems, they find themselves dogmatically connected to these symbols and ideology. And the most disturbing to me is their dedication to communism. I don't want to be like that old guy that's like, oh, yeah, fucking commies. But really, it's like, damn, these young people genuinely are into it and are reading Karl Marx and are like, oh, I agree with this very often. And that's, and so there are certain things that do bother me, even though I don't want to just force everyone to think like me. It's, there's certain things I'm like, guys, that doesn't work. It's not smart, you know?
I think censorship is an epidemic regarding that stuff. I mean, the majority of news that people take in, the air we breathe, as my brother put it brilliantly one time, I thought, the air we breathe is a liberal air, a liberal slant on most things. And that's really hard to deal with. Trump certainly isn't perfect, but, I mean, you know, they've been conservatives.
Well, okay, here's my take on that comment then really quickly is that...
Yeah, yeah.
Back in the day when they were using MK mind control on the people, and we had the 50s, right? It was very obvious that people were homogenous, doing their own thing, right?
Yeah.
And then we kind of, like, turned it upside down, and things started happening, but it was still actually their fault. Like, you know, like, we had, like, all these evil banking people getting involved and trying to influence rock and roll to make the world more chaotic. And to do a whole bunch of other shit, like, and if you have, you know, conservatives talking about how theoretically there was, or, you know, a conspiracy of the AIDS virus being put, all of this stuff happened, and we're trying to think about it, right? So now we just got to realize that the liberal air we breathe, quote, quote, is really just the way culture is trying to make us do things, right? But
exactly.
The thing is that we actually, because we have free will, we have the decision to either break from the matrix or sign up to it, you know? And I see a lot of people signing up to it, but the problem is that the people who aren't online, the people who are living conservatively, not with conservative ideals or political affiliation, but the people who are actually conserving and taking care of themselves and taking care of their children and working hard and living happily, they're not even online. Like, they don't give a fuck. You can't force them to, like, try to impress people because they're just losing their life, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Online is soft mind control for sure. I mean, depending on what you read, I mean, it's absolute. In the real world, it's totally fucking different. I agree with that 100%.
Yeah, and so that's the problem. Like, yeah, maybe we have, like, oh, there's a liberal error, you know, like, but I wouldn't get too worried about it because a lot of the people who are liberal crazy like that who are literally... who are really doing that, they're, like, either really dying off or becoming slightly more conservative to take care of themselves. You know what I mean? And I hate to say that, but really, if you just live a life of nihilism and sadness and depression, something bad happens to you or you kill yourself. And it's, like, and it happens to everybody, too, but it's evolutionarily, it's not a long-lasting venture. You know what I mean? So, you know, we could be bummed about the censorship on something like that, but in the end, the internet still is kind of the wild, wild west, and I wouldn't be too afraid of it because I don't think that our administration is going to censor us that much on the internet, and I really hope at least the next two different administrations won't limit us anymore. And I think it'd be harder for them to do so with the power that computers have, you know?
one of the funniest things I ever saw on your Facebook page, it was you reading a book, and I think it was a Newt Gingrich book, possibly. In the bottom it said, I'm reading that new fire Newt Gingrich. And literally, that's got to be the only time the word fire.
Yeah,
it's got to be.
Say it again.
There was a caption in one of your photos on Facebook. You were talking about the new this book you were reading about Newt Gingrich, and you were talking about how great the Newt Gingrich was fire. You know, I said that's the only time fire and Newt Gingrich have been mentioned in that way together. It's really, really funny, dude. Like, I literally like screenshotted that photo and sent it to my brother. I'm like, dude, look at this guy. You know.
Oh no, yeah. There's always a little bit of trolling in my book, in my game, because I know that if I do something that people are going to react a certain way, and I'm trying to maintain it so that it's not as bullying as it used to be when I was like an angry young. But yeah, the new Gingrich is fire. Well, I gotta admit, I didn't even really read that book. My friend had a new Gingrich book, but I was
Yeah, right.
Fine. I was like, you know what? I gotta put this online because like. I got my hair done. I'm like looking like a cool young kid. I'm like, that'd be so funny to just put this new Gingrich book up. And I just thought it'd be really funny, and it got the effect I wanted. I will say I need to actually do a reading of that and put on a full review of it before I feel properly intelligent enough to really call it fire. But yeah, that hopefully I'll be. I'll be doing more like weird young kid reviews of old people books because I think that that's something that needs to be done.
I actually got to meet Newt Gingrich and I had him sign a book for my grandmother. Yeah.
Oh, really? That's pretty great. Dang.
Yeah, a couple years ago, I went to the Republican National Convention.
I've never quite done anything like that, and I asked Turning Point USA to help them out with doing art and music and stuff. And I've been trying to – my biggest problem is I think that the conservative culture is just, like, dead when it comes to art, and they don't care or know the difference.
I agree.
They're just, like – yeah, I mean, that's the problem. It's, like, yeah, you have to be a liberal if you're going to be an artist. Like, mentally, you have to be free. You know, you have to be liberal and creative and open. You can't be an artist and be conservative in the same exact brain space. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can be the same person.
Brain spaces, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, you have to switch them on and off. You know, you can't just stick to one or the other, you know, or else you get, like, you know, well-done businesses with crappy logos, you know.
That's very interesting. I thought the same thing. I'm, like, thinking about these things, listening to these AM talk radio, and I'm like, hey, man, I want to go play my guitar and let my fucking hair down. You know, it's something totally different.
Oh, yeah. No, even my good buddy Luis, like, in fact, actually, that's the thing. Right near in L.A., there's a lot of Trump supporter Mexican kids who are like young boys just read Ben Carson's speeches, and you know we're interested in that stuff because we want to have a better life than, you know, a lot of the stuff that's around us, you know, and you know, in the hopes of theoretically, you know, building your own castle, you know.
Fuck yeah.
But even me and my friends will get like annoyed, like, you know what, let's not listen to Ben Shapiro today because he's got a whiny voice and he says the same thing all the time. Is he right? Maybe. Is he boring? Definitely. So, I mean, that's the thing. Like, even my lawyer, like, do I disagree with him more than Ben Shapiro? Yes, but he's more interesting, you know? But even Milo, it's like, okay, cool, now make a cool record and I'll be really interested, you know? In fact, I actually want to collaborate with some of these people and be like, you know what, guys, let's do something else, like, other than just talk about politics. Like, geez, Louise. Like, it's cool to you know, be intelligent, but I want experimental records, you know, like I want psychedelic sounds in my life.
I think you've achieved some of that, honestly, with Be Chill. It's the first of its type that I've ever heard, man.
Yeah, it's kind of surprising to me how deep these subcultures are. But yeah, that was the chiptune community was a whole deep subculture. Yeah, man. And when I first started, it was like, oh man, these are the OGs. And their first record came out like 3-4 years ago, you know? And even like the OGest of the OGs were like 40-year-old guys, you know, like not really even that old, you know. They're just like, oh yeah, well, I'm a coder and I make music, you know. It's kind of a cool thing. Malcolm McLaren, the old manager of the Sex Pistols, before he died, he wrote a few articles for NME, and one of the last articles he wrote was about how 8-bit music is the new punk. He was like, oh, you know, chiptune's the new punk, because they got new hardware and nobody comes to them and they don't care what other people think, blah, blah, blah. They're not trying to be cool. They're like, you know what? He was making all these things and I was thinking to myself, I was like 17. I was like, you know what? He's right. Like in my head, like I don't like Malcolm McLaren for X, Y, or Z, but you know what? He's freaking right. And we got to like take this as our new scene and stuff. But then eventually the scene developed into all these other weird subcultures and some of them were successful and but it never became like a real, it never became like a really outbroken new genre or anything like that, you know what I mean? And right. And I don't think that it necessarily should be either, because I think that when you see like a culture change because of one genre, I think there's mm-hmm. probably some sort of like dirty money involved behind it. And I think that the fact that chiptune didn't come out in a weird way, it's like, oh, well, it really was just a bunch of nerds trying some stuff out, you know? And hopefully that can change, but in a weird way, that cell phones are so much more. See, when we were making music on Game Boys, the cell phone wasn't quite as powerful as it is now. And now I think that mobile phones are so powerful, it's like, geez, why mess with a Game Boy, you know? Like, you can have a whole music studio in your pocket, and even, I've even made albums on the.
How do you do it, man? How do you fucking do it? Because here's the deal. I like to make my show accessible. Legitimately, like, if some kid listening right now wanted to start making music just like you made, or he was inspired by that, what would he have to get, dude? Or he or she, what would they have to get?
Oh, okay, yeah, this is something I'm really good at talking about, hardware-wise. So, let's say you want to make Game Boy music specifically. You either get an emulator on your computer to emulate and then download a Little Sound DJ ROM, or you would flash it to a homemade cartridge that you can use on a real Game Boy. There's like a different plethora of different cartridges that you can install games onto, like the EMS cart, or you can go to kitschbent.com, kitsh-bent.com. That's like a website that has a lot of modifying hardware for your Game Boy if you want to go into modifying. I was like 17, and I was like, my little brother was 12, was Pro Sound modifying his Game Boys back when he was, you know, 11, 12 years old. And so I think a lot of young people can learn it. You're probably looking at spending probably around $40 to $100, around that range, if you're going to want to get a new Game Boy set up. And to me that was cool because the Game Boy was the whole band, you know, for me. It was the lead, rhythm, drums, everything, you know. But even simpler than that now, I would consider it, although I consider the Game Boy simpler then, but now it's just simpler that I would just get music apps on your phone. Like, let's say you're a poor homeless kid right now, and you have an Obama phone, you know. I think that the smartest way to do it is to use an app called Caustic, C-A-U-S-T-I-C, on the Google Play Store. It costs $10. And it's made by one developer. This guy just does it on his own. He has a great comprehensive YouTube channel explaining how to use each of the machines and modules in the software. And and that app has, you know, 8 different synthesizers and sampling devices in it, and you can do anything. And it has a mastering console. You can mix and master your songs all yourself. It's really, really, really powerful. But also, if you have like an iPhone, there's one called Cord Gadget that has, I think, over 30 different machines on there now, as well as, and they're all like designed by Cord, and as well as a desktop version of software, so you can use it on your Mac computer with Ableton and other stuff if you want to advance more. And Cord Gadget, it costs like $15 or $20 for like the full version, but there is a free version out that you can still do a lot with. And I think that if people start using these mobile softwares to kind of make whatever music they want, then we're going to see a new renaissance. Because there was a SoundCloud renaissance, but I think that everyone's just copying each other so much, you know? And I think that now if you can do it all on your phone and it's easier to access, you're going to see a lot more young kids making clearly original, independent stuff. And I'm seeing that, but it's the people doing that are really... few, far between, and also very young and just starting out, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, that sounds totally revolutionary and amazing. I love it. Tell me a little bit about your sorry, I don't mean to cut in the segue. That was great. That was enough, though. That's enough to get people started, what you just said. You know, get them down the path, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Hopefully that'll be enough. Yeah, just look up the stuff I was searching.
Yeah, for sure. I just wrote it down while you were talking. Tell me about your artwork. Your artwork's amazing. I literally look at it and I say, I will never be able to do that. I have no idea how he does that. It's just like horrifyingly beautiful, like comic book thing. I don't know. Tell me about your artwork, dude. Tell me what you do, what you've been doing lately with it.
Well, when I was young, my dad was always drawing comics for the Snoqualmie Valley Times up when we lived in Seattle, in Snoqualmie Valley area.
Okay.
I'm from LA, but we lived there for a while. My youngest brother was born there. And so my dad was always drawn, and I looked at his art, and I just kind of copied his style of, like, cross-hatching. And I didn't understand that my dad was kind of doing the Robert Crumb style. So when I was drawing, people were like, oh, you draw like Robert Crumb or Rat Fink. And so a lot of people seeing that really influenced me into looking more into that stuff, you know. I was like, oh, what's this? What's that? You know. And so I was just heavily influenced by the West Coast comic art genre and Spain, like, you know, Spain Rodriguez, Robert Williams, all those guys. And my parents were extremely, extremely encouraging of that. And when me and I have three younger brothers. When we were in trouble, we would have to, like, rewrite from the encyclopedia, you know. And so when we weren't in trouble, we weren't allowed to play video games. We'd just be given a pad of paper and pencils, and that was like, oh, cool, this is like fun time. We get to draw, you know. And they weren't very like, we were kind of early on. We were kind of unschooled. We didn't really go to public school. We had like a private. My mom just like taught us stuff, and we went to the state test, and we passed. So it was kind of like a very free form environment. And in this free-form environment, most of the things that I was doing was just drawing, tracing from TVs and stuff. And then also, I don't know, I think every kid kind of has like a time of dissociation and kind of does one certain thing. But when I kind of went through my little issues in my childhood or whatever, I dissociated very quickly into just illustration. And that was just like the simplest thing that was accessible. I could access it any time, just get a piece of paper and a pencil, find it. You know, it was just, I was just always zoning out. So those drawings that I do are just obsessive and continuous. And I would encourage more people to dissociate into illustrating things if they can.
So
you have, like, some issues.
From trauma, basically, a way to do something else to get your mind. That's interesting thought, man, because I think that probably runs in a lot of artists' lives like that.
Yeah, I think it's painfully more obvious than most artists are willing to talk about, you know. But I think that that's generally the case.
Wow.
Because, I don't know, a lot of my friends, I'll talk to them, whenever we get into really deep conversations, like, oh, what did you go through as a kid? You know, how did you deal with that? Da da da. And in a lot of ways, it's almost everybody has like a very similar story. Like, oh yeah, blah 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 happened. It really sucked. I didn't know what else to do, and I had a keyboard around, or I had whatever device was around, you know. And very often that turns into much more. Destructive habits, and you know, and for me, it was also a very destructive habit too, because I dissociated so much that I never got like a regular job. I was obsessively drawing all the time, and it was kind of like I was ruining a lot of my relationships and my friendships just because I was so obsessively creative, addictively creative, you know, that it doesn't always end up in being a strength, but in the end, it's still a strength if you create enough and you push yourself enough to keep getting better and not just stop at one level. But so the reason I get into such detail in those drawings is because I'm always trying to challenge my more dynamic or more hidden messages in the next drawing, you know?
That's amazing, dude. Now, how did you, You told me you worked on the amazing record by Ariel Pink dedicated to Bobby Jamison. I didn't realize that. What went on with that, dude? How did that? What did you do on that record?
I had, when I first met Ariel, I had a friend that died, and me and this other person who was a mutual for my friend Sarah Hildebrand, we were both hanging out and becoming friends after our friend had died, and it was kind of like a hard moment where all of, like, a large group of us were just kind of like drinking and doing drugs and just getting depressed because our buddy was dead, you know. And he was a real strong power in the community, that the weird underground community. His name was Billy Hendrickson. He was a he made monster costumes, and I was his roommate and stuff. But around that time, when we were all getting over his passing, Sarah introduced me to Ariel just by like hanging out. She was his friend, and Ariel was just super caring and listening. He didn't even know him, but he was just like, "Damn, you guys must really respect this guy," you know. And so he was just like a caring, loving person that was around. And I left my jacket at his place that like one time, and then I didn't see him for like a year. I went back, and I saw him at some club, and he was like, "Hey, you left your jacket at my house a while back, and I still got it. You want to come get it? Come back after the show." We hung out, and we continued to hang out and write songs, because all I'm doing is writing songs all the time. I have my iPad, using my iPad. But then when Bobby Jamison came around, he was just, "All right, guys, if anyone wants to hang out, you can't hang out unless you're helping me with the record. You can't come by unless you're doing something productive. You have to write lyrics or melodies or something. You know, you can't just hang out because you think you're cool, you know?" And
So
that's when Ariel would have me come over, because I'm never one to just, like, goof off. You know, if you got the instruments out, I'm going to jam. I'm going to record something, write some lyrics. So Ariel would give me, like, lists and lists of ideas, and I would take notes, and then I would elaborate on them, and then he would elaborate on those. So I wrote some lyrics for the album. Well, primarily the lyrics that I came up with were on the Santa's in the Closet song. We were even coming up with ideas for a music video that never got made, but it was just like a real hardcore brainstorm. And he had a bunch of singles that he was working on. We would add synth parts and stuff. So I don't think anyone's really, like, that heavily, like, specifically credited on the album, because it's, like, kind of hard to tell who did what, because it's such a hodgepodge of stuff, you know? But he really was a deeply appreciative, awesome friend. And he was, like, even when the album was coming out and stuff, he paid me to do, like, these trading cards that are not quite out yet, but he was, like, he saw I was going through a certain tough time and I wasn't asking for help. But he was like, "Okay, well, how about I just offer, like, how about we do something cool together, you know?" I was like, "Well, let's do these trading cards.
Yeah, the Graffiti Pail Kid.
Yeah, the Graffiti Pail Kid. That was the project I did.
Oh, those are amazing. I had no idea those were you. I love those cards, dude.
My partner, well, the color, I did the black and white part of it, and I'm still finishing them up. But my partner, Uni Hollow, she was a coloring them digitally. We're both working on our iPads, and I just thought that her style was just so much more vibrant and electric. So I thought, you know, you color them, and
killer.
And I think that it was a great partnership, and hopefully they'll come out soon. We just finished the last. Like, there was a few bumps in the road with that. Technically, it was supposed to be released for the Bobby Jamison tour, but the Mexican Summer didn't want to do it because they didn't want to get in trouble with Graffiti Pail Kids or Garbage Pail Kids, etc. And we were like, well, whatever. So Ariel was just like, "All right, we'll just make them for us," you know. And so that kind of slowed the whole thing down. And then, but now they're on back on track to getting finished by January.
So they will be on sale in physical form.
I think we're just gonna release some free ones. You know what I mean? There might not be anything for sale. Is the point? Is
because. Oh, okay. Okay.
In order to maintain a legal fortitude, because also then we have to get NDAs, or not NDAs, but like disclosure agreements from the artists on the cards, which even though they're all friends, it's like more of a technical headache than we'd all like to deal with, you know what I mean? So I don't think they'll be on sale, but we, but there are definitely some really cool new things. In fact, I'm coming up with trading cards for the Needle Drop, you know, Anthony Fantano.
Yeah.
I'm making some like Yu-Gi-Oh looking cards for him, and hopefully some more. I want to do some other stuff with Ariel, but that we could sell, because I think trading cards are a good concept. But yeah, I think the graffiti bill just became more of a legal hassle than we thought originally.
I mean, okay, I guess my point is, whether they're for sale or not, are they actually going to be in cards or just an online thing?
Oh, no, we're going to make them cards. But, well, basically, Ariel's idea is that he just wants one set for himself framed in his house. And I told him, I don't know, man, I think more people want them at least.
Tell him J-Bo wants one as well.
Yeah, so that's why I think that part of him thinking about if we put out a bunch of them, that he'll just give them to fans or something, you know, like give out card packs for free. So that, you know, there's no legal issue, but we can still have the people who think it's cool enjoy them, you know?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, listen, man, I want to thank you so much. Thank you so much, Juan. Thank your father for letting us use his cell phone. And I didn't know what to expect, and as soon as you opened your mouth, I knew this was going to be good. A lot of knowledge, a lot of great energy. I appreciate it, man.
Thank you very much, man. And, yeah, it's been great talking to you. It's refreshing to have someone interview you who actually listened to the music beforehand.
Oh, it's so, cool. Thank you. Killer.
Thanks, man. Have a good one, dude. God bless.
They say you're dangerous. Are you dangerous?
Yeah. Yeah, actually.
Yeah. Why?
Why are you dangerous?
Don't look dangerous.
It depends when you see me, I think. Why? Because I think that someone who's trying to be good should be dangerous. Like, otherwise, there's no force to you. There's nothing to contend with. You know, we have this strange idea that's especially, again, foisted on young men, that the pathway to virtue is through weakness and harmlessness. And that's just simply not true. That's the pathway to uselessness and resentment. You should be able to be a monster and then not be one.
C.S. Lewis said there are different definitions of love. There are clearly different definitions of danger, too.
Yes.
Thank you for being with us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.